Welcome to the Hairdryer Treatment Podcast, powered by Kevin Grogan Soccer, Soccer Coffee, and much more. Hi everyone, welcome to the show. It's podcast number 10. We've done 10 weeks in a row, which we're very happy with. Thank you very much for listening. We've had some big following. We've had a lot of positive feedback, a lot of constructive criticism, which we like as well. We're in the process of negotiating a deal with a studio in Brooklyn so we can get the quality of sound better and the editing process better. So really want to thank everyone for tuning in. We're delighted to have an interview with Mark Wilson later on. Mark is a former Manchester United player and tells a really, really interesting story from his time in Manchester and how he evolved into the business end of soccer now with a company called Beyond Pulse. It's really, really interesting. So after the break, we'll have Mark Wilson. Thank you.
We may be the chihuahua.
You are an ostrich.
Eggs. Dilly din, dilly dong. Come on.
But I want to be clear that I don't want to play mind games.
But I think it was an angry man. I think he was disturbed for some reason or other.
Honestly, I will love it if we beat them.
Okay, Mark, first of all, talk about how you first got identified by Manchester United.
Oh, wow, that takes me back. A gentleman called Ron Cattell, who sadly passed away a few years back, he was a scout for Manchester United, and I was playing for Scunthorpe Schools team, which was a select group of players from different schools, and I had no idea that Ron was passing by or even, you know, part of Manchester United, but I remember this particular day in this particular game, I looked over to the coaches, to the sideline where the coach was, and he was speaking to somebody, slightly older guy who then disappeared after 15 minutes. I remember looking back around, maybe in 10 or 15 minutes, recalling from my own memory, but I went into the dressing room after the game, and the coach came over to me and said, oh, you should expect a call from that guy tomorrow. And I was like, oh, okay, great. Didn't think anything of it. And the following morning, and just to recap, I was 13 years old at this point. The phone rang in the morning, and my mom picked it up. And I could just see this look on her face. I remember having breakfast, and she just kept kind of saying, yeah, okay, that's great, that's fantastic. Hung the phone up and said, that was Manchester United. And it's me, this kid from Scunthorpe, this small town, knowing that he, you know, had a bit of ability, but you never know in the grand scheme of things where you sit. And from that point forward, he kind of invited me over to the Cliff Training Ground for a week in a school holiday. And I bounced all the way to school that day, floated all the way to school, just thinking of being in that environment as it was my boyhood club.
And the first time you went over then for a trial and training, who would have been in charge then of the youth setup? Was Les Kershaw involved and people like that?
Yep, so Les was there to meet and greet. I met with Eric Harrison as well, which was a scary moment as a 13-year-old.
Yeah, talk about Eric Harrison, because he's, for our listeners, he's a legend in the game and a big reason why a lot of the top players, the Beckhams and the Scholes and Giggsies, came through the system. How did you find him?
Eric was, you talk about this player-coach relationship that has meaning, that has value. And Eric had a way of making you feel like you belonged. So he'd let you know that the standards were high, that this was always going to be a challenge every time you stepped foot on the field. And at this early point, there was no guarantee. I mean, I remember, you know, 50, 60 players being there over this whole week. And they're looking and evaluating. And Eric would just dip in and out. He'd make a comment or two. If he did something well in the practice, he would not pull you aside, but as you're walking off the field, he'd make a point to you about something you'd done well. And he was very endearing, although he had this demeanor like you knew if you stepped out of line, you're going to be in trouble. But that was a Manchester United way and a mantra.
He wasn't unlike Sir Alex Ferguson in his demeanour. He was kind of, there was a fear factor there and a respect, yet he obviously very much cared about your well-being.
Absolutely, and you know this as well, Kev. I mean, he very much mirrored some of the personality traits that the gaffer had. And I think that was important, because when you come into a club with the history that Manchester United has and with the expectation on the type of player they want to develop, you have to have that, those moments of adversity, those moments where you have to be resilient in any environment, certainly in that environment, to propel you forward. And they always wanted to see what you did during those moments of adversity, whether that was being tested in practice, being called out for making mistakes in the right way, or just being, you know, in that high tempo, high octane environment.
I remember once playing and scoring a hat trick and being dropped the week after. And looking back, it was definitely a test. Do you find something in? You find it in America that maybe the kids aren't tested enough in terms of that? It's too soft, the coaches on the kids.
Could you imagine that, having somebody score a hat trick here and not play the next game? And certainly a DA, ECNL, NPL level, probably not. But I feel that there's a balance. I tend not to look at black and white or absolutes anymore. I try and be as open-minded as possible about the path you and I both came through. Think about the dynamics and more importantly, the social dynamics we were involved in then, and that was a part of our daily lives. Then I think about the progression to where I am now as a nearly a 40-year-old. Time's flying by. And think, where's the middle ground? So there's certainly an element of us running through the brick wall for our players and parents running through the brick wall with the kid dragging along behind. That needs to adapt, whereas probably back in our day, it was go run through that brick wall and figure out, you know, what you learned from it, and I'll be there the other side to pick you up and dust you down to go again. Yeah. There's not enough of that, in my opinion. Certainly at the more elite levels of the game, before we're going into DA and professional, there's not enough balance in terms of putting our players through challenges within practices and even when they go away from your environment, setting challenges for them that will create that adversity.
Sure. And just going back there, so was it a case of when you were 13 to maybe 16, you went over on all your school holidays to train? Mm-hmm. At what point was there an indication that they wanted to sign you full time?
So I was very fortunate. And again, I go back to being from a very small town in England. I never knew whether I was good, you know, middle ground across the country or up there with the elite. And I was fortunate to go on trials to be part of the Lillishaw group, which was the FA National School of Excellence, which was 16 players from 2 year groups, 15s and 16s that stayed there for 2 years. And you were basically the England team. This was before we had academies. Mm-hmm. As soon as I started to make my way through those trials and I made it to the final national trial, I then got an offer. But then all the offers come in. So you the likes of Everton and Newcastle, yeah, and other clubs that in all honesty were throwing money around at my parents at that point, yeah, too.
There was a lot of money at that time from certain clubs. Manchester United were a bit more strict with their finances. And,
they were.
Yeah.
They were. And my dad recalls and reminds me to this day what some of that money could have done for him back then. And he said, you know, purely to two clubs in particular, it's my son's choice, and where he chooses to go, he will go. And there was only one place for me.
But I think Manchester United were more of the philosophy, well, we're the best club, we'll give you the best development, we'll, yep, look after you, and a lot of kids that they wanted obviously went because of that.
Yeah, looking back, that was a good stance to take, because you're keeping it about the game,
yeah,
you're keeping it about the player, the club, the badge, what it means. You're keeping it about culture as well, rather than focusing on the materialistic value of the money, you know, that you could maybe pay to get a 16-year-old to come into your environment back then.
So you went away with Lillishaw at 14 to, yep, 16 full-time. What was that, yep, like going away at 14 years of age full-time?
An experience that I would argue helped me become a professional football player, professional soccer player. You know, the bell would ring at 6 a.m. in the morning. We would have different jobs to do, whether it's showers, toilets, cleaning boots, prepping the changing rooms or the gear for the night before, the training equipment. You would go downstairs, do that first, come back upstairs, get showered, get your uniform on, go down, have breakfast, then go off to school.
Yeah.
So you're creating professional habits as a 14-year-old, as hard as that can be. You're playing games every weekend against what would now be considered Premier League academies. You are considered the best 16 players in the country at that point. I mean, that's very subjective still, but in reality, we went through 2 years and never lost a game to a Premier League team.
And some top players came out of that system.
Yeah, they did. You know, Michael Owen, Wes Brown, Andy Cole, Joe Cole. I mean, there is quite a list of players that came out of there. And, you know, part of that group always becomes the England schoolboy group. So now you're going away to, you know, I remember two games in Germany. We played Germany in the Olympic Stadium in Berlin in front of 62,000 people as a 15-year-old. And, you know, we beat them happily. You know,
and you feel for the players that went through that system, in comparison to the ones that didn't and signed full-time for clubs at 16, did you feel you were ahead of them?
This is a point up for debate. Now, having gone through the Lillishall experience and playing for your country can do one of two things. It can make you complacent.
Okay.
And one of the best things I had said to me as a young 16-year-old was from Eric Harrison, if I recall rightly. You know, he made a point, and you boys have come in from playing for England, being on TV, doing all your fancy celebrations when you score. You're now at the bottom of the ladder. You're now at the bottom of the ladder, and you're at Manchester United, and now you're trying to knock out Eric Cantona or Ryan Giggs or Paul Scholes. And it's a rude awakening.
Yeah.
And if you rock up to that club thinking you are bigger than the badge, and because you play for your country and you're 16 and you think you've made it, you're in for a rude awakening. And there were players that went to Lillishall, that went to United with me, that fell by the wayside.
That's one thing, you know, I always say that if you meet anyone that came through the Manchester United system, whether they made it or didn't make it, you very rarely would meet someone that is big-headed or arrogant. They did teach us how to be grounded and work hard. Did you find that?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it was something that resonated with me. I don't know whether it was my upbringing, very working class background, as you know, probably the same for you, Kev. And you have that drive, desire to try and be something or be successful at something. And the minute you get into that club, you feel this cultural, you know, kind of family. This is about us. It's we. It's not you and how well you can do and how many goals you can score and how well you're performing. It's about you being a part of something greater than who you are.
Yeah.
You know, so it resonated with me in terms of, yes, you're never allowed to get above your station. You're always pulled back in by the group. And as you progress through the ranks there, you humbly step up.
Yeah.
Not because you're the star. You humbly step up because you've got something to prove now at another tier of your development. If you didn't have that mindset, you were pulled apart quickly and you were...
It was a hard school though, wasn't it?
You were
as well?
Discarded. Yeah, you were. You're an expendable asset. And if you don't have the mentality at that point, if you go into the first team and crumble because the gaffer or Keane or Scholesy are drilling you for being better on the ball, for taking up better positions. And I remember in practice a couple of times I would play passes that in Roy's mind were too simple.
Yeah.
Know your players, pick your passes. In other words, can you recognise that this was a moment to go forward rather than you just keeping the ball? And it made me think differently about the game. So, yeah.
He was always about play forward quick.
Yeah, he was.
Be positive, play forward, get at them.
Yep, and you could see his body language always looked like he was going to play forward. Yeah. And then he played the sideways passes to open up gaps and draw players out when he needed to. But just so many great players to learn from. But, yeah, it was a tough environment, a very cutthroat environment.
And in terms of back then, I know there was a lot of kind of jobs you had to do after training for it was YTS, youth training schemes. What was your job and where do you stand on that? That doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, after training, we'd have to go in and do certain things.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I do believe that it's still the first thing I do today now is make my bed when I get up. It's my first task done in the day and it's a simple task. But once I get that done, I can move forward. And I think having to do jobs, if it's managed and overseen in the right way, is valuable for good habit building, for consistency in what you're doing. And mine was showers and toilets. And I've told this story a million times, I think.
Is this the cricket bat story?
It is the cricket bat story. I only saw it with it a couple of times. I don't know who gave it, but he used to walk around tapping this mini cricket bat.
This is Sir Alex Ferguson, yeah.
This was a gaffer, yeah. And he... You'd hear him tapping it on the rails as he's walking down the old stairs at the cliff, and he'd come down and he'd call a name or two, like, Wilson, come with me. So you'd walk down the little flight of steps again and you'd go into the first team dressing room, and he would run his fingers through the tiles and around the back of the toilet and see if I'm doing my job properly. And I remember this one particular day, I hadn't done a good enough job, half-assed it basically, excuse the language. And the gaffer was like, look, if I can't trust you to do this properly in here when I'm not looking, how am I ever going to trust you out there in front of 70,000 fans when all eyes are on you and I'm relaying key detail to you in a week that you now have to put into practice or put into the game now live with all this pressure surrounding you? You can't do it in here simply when nobody's looking.
Yeah.
What chance have you got? And it was a rude awakening.
And they've kind of moved away from that now, yeah, where, you know, child labour laws and different things. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. There needs to be a balance. I think there is a lot of value in it, cleaning boots and washing different things.
What did you have to do? What was your job?
Well, I used to do the showers. Yeah. And obviously you clean the boots, you know, and we'd all want to try and get the best player in terms of the tip for Christmas.
Yeah,
some of the players used to tip us. So that was always a fight. But I thought it was very good. I think there needs to be a balance with that. Now, just talking about the Cliff training ground, for those who don't know, it's a legendary, they're not there anymore. Obviously, the first team and reserves would be over in Carrington, which is a state-of-the-art facility. But I was always amazed with the Cliff because, you know, even in like 98, 99, when the club was thriving, the Cliff was very old, but it was legendary because of all the great players that had played there over the years. How did you find that?
I loved the place. And I went back with a friend just before the holiday period. And it's so nostalgic driving up and going through the big red gates, yeah, and having a look in through the window and seeing the big glass window where the gaffer and Eric Harrison used to bang on if you made a poor pass or you were losing a game. And I love that environment. You were so close to the first team. You could sit on the little embankment around and watch them.
So it was a small training ground,
yeah,
big windows looking out onto one field.
One field, that was it. There was one indoor facility, and look, the facilities were minimal at best, you know. And but that added to the environment.
I always said if they didn't have the Manchester United logo there, yeah, back then, you wouldn't have known it was a Manchester United training ground, but it had something special about it.
It did, and you remember the little triangle piece, Wembley up at the top, we'd go up there and practice and finishing and whatever else. I remember one sliding tackle session with Gary Neville we had to do a couple of times. But yeah, it was a phenomenal environment, and one that there's an element of that culture, that togetherness missing from somebody. Super clubs, the training environments as high tech, as fancy and amazing as they are, I don't know, there's just a little bit of substance missing from those old style training grounds.
So you obviously started progressing really well when you went full time, and you're doing really well in the youth and then reserves. And I remember when I first came, you were in the reserves and we kind of all looked up to you as one of the kind of big talents. And then you started getting into the first team. What was that experience like when you first got called into the squad? And
firstly, that's humbling. You know, you're always worried about the players coming in below you that they want to take a spot. And I'm sure you had that mentality, Kev, or you wouldn't have been there. And it's always nice to know that there's, you know, hearing it now that you do look up, and we looked up again to the first team.
Absolutely.
You're admiring players, but at the same time, you're thinking, can I take his place? And I got into a rhythm at United playing for the reserves that I really played some of my most attacking football with freedom.
Yeah.
Because I'd have Mick Phelan and Jim Ryan saying, well, you're here because you've got this badge on. You're here because you've got talent. You're wearing this jersey because we believe in you. Go out and express, you know, we'll give you key pointers. But play what you feel. And that's a really important thing. You think of those words, how simple they were, but how meaningful they are. And you've got to play with feeling. You've got to play with foresight and understanding the things you take from practice into a game and how they're going to work differently.
They never turned players into robots. It was always go out and express yourself.
Always. And you know, they wanted to encourage you, certainly from an attacking mentality, go and try things. Don't be afraid to get it wrong. Now, if you get it wrong too many times, you're going to get it a little bit. Yeah. And that's understandable because you've got to learn. And for me, it was having Mick Phelan and having Jim Ryan, and even still the interactions with Paul McGuinness and Eric Harrison around that period of my development. And I had a spell with Brian Kidd too. I mean, four or five incredible mentors that, you know, certainly helped propel me into only 10 first team games. But still, it was an environment in the reserves at that point that had a lot of talent and ability where even Jordy Cruyff and Nicky Butt, they would drop down and first team players would come and play with you. And you would play against other first teams. I remember a Liverpool game playing against Redknapp and Fowler and Biscan and Smidza and players that were first team quality playing in the Champions League. And here we are on a Saturday afternoon or Saturday morning.
A lot of first teamers would play reserves if they needed minutes or they were coming back from an injury or there was squad rotation or whatever. Yeah.
So it was a phenomenal environment. And again, I had a spell in the reserves. It was kind of a little piece that we haven't touched upon between my Eric Harrison days in the youth team and being a reserve team player. I went on loan to Wrexham for a spell.
Okay.
And as harsh as this may sound, you know, the gaffer was like, look, I see you propelling into reserves and then hopefully into my first team. You've got to go and play with men. And I'm 17, 18 at this point. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you're going to go to Wrexham? Like, firstly, where's Wrexham?
Yeah.
Secondly, you know, what do I expect? And Brian Flynn had watched me a couple of times and thought I would fit the bill as an attacking midfielder for a League One team. And he'd sent Beckham out to Preston in League One. Scholes had gone out somewhere before. And
it was a big thing that Sir Alex did. He'd send young players out to give them that experience, because no matter how much you play in a youth team or a reserves, you have to play with men, as you said.
100%. These are guys looking to put food on the table for the families, playing for points, playing to get promoted, not get relegated. And I made a commitment to Wrexham and a commitment to Brian Flynn. And, you know, the first thing I asked in an interview, and I don't know where this came from because I'm still a naive, very young 18-year-old, you know, I said, I'd like you not to refer to me as the Manchester United loanee for the next 3 months. Yeah. I'm a Wrexham player. I needed to embed myself and help the players around me, the senior players in this team, that I was fully committed to their cause of getting promoted. And that was an amazing learning curve, because 3 months later, we're a point off getting promoted. We won the Welsh FA Cup, whatever that means nowadays. And I scored 7 or 8 goals playing an attacking style under Brian Flynn, who I met again at Swansea and played under again at Swansea years later. But that was kind of the kickstart for me to then come back into the reserves and get into the first team.
I presume that gave you massive confidence then that you were coming back after playing with adults and playing in that cutthroat environment.
Yep, it did. It gave me the belief that I couldn't just do it against 17, 18, 19, 20-year-olds.
Yeah. The big test, isn't it?
Yeah, I could do it against men. I mean, I remember being in a tunnel against Gillingham and Adi Akinbaye and Andy Hessenthaler were stood there, and I'm walking out, you know, scored 3 or 4 goals in the league. This is my 7th or 8th game, and I hear this, that's him. And I turn around, I'm like, talking about me, and he's, both of them are staring at me.
Yeah.
Like, he's not going to be at it today. And they're just getting in my ear, walking out, and I've got big Brian Carey, who was ex-Man United, with his hands on my shoulders, like, turning my head back to face forward. Like, don't worry. And thankfully, after 9 or 10 minutes, I scored, and that kind of set the tone and settled me down as well. So, just good experiences and times when you have to be resilient.
Yeah, and then you went back to United then into the reserves straight away and then built your way up. And then can you remember the first time you got called into the squad?
I do. I got called into the squad for the year we won the treble. And nobody had any idea we were on that pathway at this point to play or be on the bench against Bromby. I think it was a 6-2 victory we had. And at that point, I felt kind of ready because I'd been in and around the first team, been training with them every day. We had a nice group, Wes Brown, Jonathan Green in, Phil Morine, a couple of others. And
he's a priest now.
He is a priest now, yeah.
I remember reading that. That'll be an interesting podcast.
Yeah.
Great player.
He was a great player, yeah. Just again, I think, you know, maybe, I don't know what happened injury-wise, but that consistency, you know, maybe hindered him in having a longer career, but yeah, the group of players we had and where we felt we were, you felt like you'd earned your place, and got named on the subs bench and came on for the last 25 minutes. Really enjoyed the outing, and nice things are written about you, but that's the time not to get complacent. That's the time to put your head down. And
did you find it was a massive step up in that game, or what? Or in some ways, was it easier because you were surrounded by all these amazing players?
I came on at 4-2 and 5-2 and, you know, we scored one more goal, and I'm surrounded by, you know, my dream midfield. It's like Scholes, it's Beckham, it's Giggs, I've got Cole and York in front of me. And
I mean, they're all amazing. Was there one that stood out more than the others? I mean,
I've got to say that the most fun I had was playing, and this was my home debut the year after we'd won the treble, and it was against Croatia Zagreb, and standing in that tunnel, and I've got Paul Scholes in front of me, I've got Giggs behind me, and Beckham a couple in front. I'm like, all right, if I can't play with these boys, then I can't play.
Yeah.
But Paul Scholes, without doubt.
A lot of ex-pros say he was the best.
I could run anywhere and know I was going to have the ball.
Yeah.
But then I could say the same about a Beckham or a Giggs, is they could find you. So you knew the runs you were making weren't in vain. If they didn't play it, they just didn't play it because they saw something else that was they thought was of more value. And but you never felt you were wasting runs.
Were they a big help to you? Was there a particular players that kind of took you under their wing, or was it just kind of general comments here or there?
They made you feel like you deserve to be there, and also intrinsically you have to feel like you belong there,
yeah.
Or you're not going to be out there. And
you have to have that confidence when you walk in the dressing room.
But I also think there was an element of, you're not going to take my place.
Yeah, that's an interesting dynamic. Talk about that.
So nobody, I don't think, when you talk about United, you think about the class of 92 and how unique they were. And, you know, you've got players there. And my first discussion with a gaffer about whose position he saw me taking, he said, you score goals from midfield. You're a goal-scoring midfielder, so I see you taking Nicky's place. You're going to challenge him this year for his place. I'm like, all right, cool. I can live with that. I'd have said the same response or had the same response if it had said Scholes or Keane, because that was what he wanted from you.
Mm-hmm.
But Nicky Butt was a phenomenal player.
Oh, yeah, brilliant.
You know, you think back to World Cups he played for England and the type of player he was. Great, great player. And the fact that the gaffer was expecting me to take his place, again, gives you that boost. And there's the cute way he could get into you to make you feel like you belonged and you had an opportunity there. So I think from that perspective, trying to break that class of 92 down, there was an internal bond with those boys. And not to say we didn't have it with Wes or myself or Jonathan Greenan or Ronnie Walwork or Danny Higginbottom, you know, that group of players. We weren't as together trying to remove them, whereas they were a solid group of players who backed each other to the hilt and had created, you know, they performed well together for 2 or 3 years at that point.
Yeah.
As young players, and we knew we weren't going to outlast them because they were still young. I think we tried to do it as individuals and it became very difficult. And
sure.
I'm speaking about all of this having spent 13 or 14 years of age to 21 and I only played 10 first team games.
Yeah, still an amazing achievement. And you obviously then moved on to Middlesbrough. Was that something like you really wanted? Was that a case of going out and knowing you could get first team football regularly?
I'll be honest, and I think it's time probably in my life to be very candid about choices I made. And I still had 3 years left to run on my deal at United at that point. I was a year into a four-year deal. And I would go away on England under 21 trips and be with the likes of Defoe and John Terry and Ledley King and Joe Cole. And you get caught up in the what are you making scenario.
Yeah.
I'm on 20, 25 grand a week, but I think I'm worth 30, 40 grand a week. And this is listening to people like Joe Cole and John Terry speak about what they're making at these clubs. And I remember a conversation about Ashley Cole going to Barcelona, sat around a pool, and the money that was being banded around, and myself and Jonathan Green, and who were in the squad at the time, you're kind of looking going, well, we're nowhere near that.
Yeah, because again, Manchester United were very strict on their finance. You didn't actually make proper money until you were established first teamer.
Yep.
Where these other clubs, once you showed that potential, you were on big money.
Yeah, well, back in the day, you get 20 grand a week for being 18, now, 19. Yeah. But yeah, so we would go back and we're thinking, well, there's got to be some level of parity. If you're Roy Keane on 90,000 a week and you're Mark Wilson trying to make your way, but you're playing games and you're in the first team squad and you're training with them every day, why is there so much disparity in salary? And my biggest regret is making my career about money. Because although I did push to leave a club that gave me everything I could want in terms of setting me up for success post-playing, I made it about something material. It wasn't about my love of the game or my love for the club.
But it is hard at that time, as you said, because there's so many players getting certain amounts of money and there is a scene there, the cars and the clothes and the houses and all that.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. And I think I definitely got wrapped up into that. And you can see the inconsistency in when I went to Middlesbrough, maybe only played 30, 40 more Premier League games and went on loans. Don't get me wrong, to good clubs, Stoke City, Sheffield Wednesday, Swansea City, went up to the Scottish Premier League and played. And I loved all of my time with those clubs. But ultimately, I made a decision based on a material value. And yes, you've got to make your money in the game while you can. But with 3 years left to run on a deal, because I was probably having my head turned, being a very naive young 20, 21-year-old, that's my one regret, maybe not seeing out another year or two.
And seeing where it could have gone.
Yeah, because I had 5 years at Middlesbrough, and I loved my time at Middlesbrough, but I was inconsistent for one reason or another.
It's hard when you leave a club like Manchester United, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Jono and I walked in, and Steve McLaren bought us from United when he joined Borough. And the first day we walked in, he said, this ain't United, boys. We were like, what do you mean? You've got Paul Ince, Alan Boxic, Juninho coming in, rumours about Mendieta being bought, Southgate, Ehiog, top-class players. And you're like, what do you mean it's not United? And we went down a big hill at Hurworth at the training ground there, and we could tell immediately that the tempo wasn't quite there and the standard wasn't quite there, and it was acceptable to give the ball away in possession games. And
sorry, that was a big difference with United. Like, yeah. The sessions weren't rocket science, but
nope,
it was the
simple
intensity of it. You were never allowed to have a bad session in terms of intensity, nope. Whether that was with Eric Harrison and Neil Bailey, or yep, in reserves with Jim Ryan or Brian, yep, Kidd, whoever it was at first team level. It was that level of intensity.
Yep, you've experienced it, Kevin, and you know that it was relentless, this relentless pursuit of being your very best every day. And even if you were having a horrendous day on the ball, you were expected to work with and without the ball regardless at your maximum intensity. And the higher up you go, obviously, the quality's got to be there too.
Yeah.
So at Middlesbrough, it was a little different. And I, you know, I saw the club develop and build, and even through my own petulance at times and probably costing myself games from having too many subjective discussions about why I thought I should be playing. And even off the back of good performances, sometimes you get dropped. That's life. But
yeah,
I wasn't mature enough at that point. And I think when you look at the numbers in my entire career of where I found my consistency, I think that came with a level of maturity towards,
yeah,
understanding the game, the manager's difficulties in keeping a squad happy. I started to learn that probably post my 2 years in the MLS.
But it is hard because you are young at the time, so it's hard to have that maturity. And you obviously had them loan spells and then went on to FC Dallas, I believe,
yeah,
over here. What was that experience? A different culture? You obviously live here now, but back then, was it a big culture shock?
If I'm being very candid and honest again, I was trying to escape the place I was in mentally with the game, having left United, gone to Middlesbrough as, you know, as a reasonably big signing for a 21-year-old at that point, and just having a very inconsistent, horrible time. So
yeah,
I needed to clear my head if I was going to continue to play this game. So I left in the last year of a 5-year deal, and I came to the MLS, and I'll be honest, it was one of the best things I could have done, because it introduced me to different mentalities, different culture. Texas was great. We moved into the new kind of soccer purpose-built stadium, brilliantly named Pizza Hut Park, and had 2 good years. And it was only personal circumstances that took me away from the US back then. Had it not been for those circumstances, I may have stayed and finished out my career in the MLS and stayed here.
And was that experience a big part in why you eventually moved back here?
It was, yeah. Look, I went through a little bit of a turbulent patch when I went back home, because in everybody else's eyes, imagine the MLS in 2005 to 2007, although for me, the standard was very high.
Yeah, but people didn't respect it.
Didn't respect it, didn't know it. So I went in on loan to a club called Barnsley, and Andy Richard was like, where have you been for 2 years? And I was like, I'm in trouble at this point, because I've now got to go out and reprove myself.
Yeah.
And I even had Colin Todd at Bradford say, you tick the boxes, you know, technically, tactically, experience-wise, but I don't think your hunger's there. Why did you go to the MLS? And in his head, that meant my desire,
yeah,
had gone. And all those moments do, and ever since I've been, you know, 10, 11 years old, when I was told I wasn't good enough for my hometown team, they spur me on. I don't mind that.
Yeah.
I don't mind that little bit of adversity thrown at me. And 2 weeks later, I went to Doncaster. And
you had a great run there. You racked up a lot of appearances.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, maybe 150, 160 appearances at Doncaster and 5 great years where we got promoted out of the champion, out of the League One into the Championship and won our first trophy. And we, funny enough, we played Bradford in my second game for Doncaster, and we beat them 2-0 at their place. And I think the assistant manager knew that they decided not to take me up on a 1-year deal. And I immediately after the whistle blew ran across to the sideline, and the assistant manager came running down because he thought I was going to confront Colin Todd, who was the manager at that time. And I just ran up to Colin and thanked him.
Yeah,
you know, saying, look, good luck for the season and thank you for your time and opening your doors for a trial and good luck. And I saw the assistant manager kind of slow down and, as he could hear, start to smile. And I do think those moments, you've got to see in a positive light, not in, I'll show you from a negative perspective, yeah, but I'll prove to you from a positive perspective.
You were a bit more mature then and a bit older, where maybe as a 21-year-old, we can't act like that.
Exactly. Well, maybe
not that we can't, but maybe we're just not mature enough.
And I think that's where I admire Premier League players who are able to come in at 18, 19, 20 and hold down a regular place. I think there's a level of maturity that they might not even be aware of.
Yeah.
In why they're able to play so many games at young ages. And Wayne Rooney, I mean, you'd look at him and maybe critique him in terms of, you know, what he says, how he says it, academically, whatever you want, whatever that means. He's a football genius. You know, and there's a guy in Baltimore at the minute working on neuroscience, trying to prove that there's a level of sporting genius that rivals academic genius. And for me, Wayne Rooney would go into that category as being somebody who understood at a level of maturity for understanding the game and how to work within the game.
He's underestimated in some ways by some people, isn't he? He's one of the greats.
He's one of the greats. And I look at Wayne Rooney as that type of person who, to play that many games, not just on ability alone,
yeah,
but to maintain that level of performance from being 16 is phenomenal.
And even coming over here and doing such a great job.
He's doing a fantastic job, and, you know, he's an asset for me to any club. And whatever experiences and knowledge he's got up there from his perspective will have huge value for young players if they're around him.
Absolutely. So you eventually moved back to America. Was that a big decision? Was that how did that come about? I know you initially came over, I think, as a director of coaching of a club.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to. There's two things could have happened. I could have retired at 33 and gone into the game there and made my way into an academy somewhere, or I could really test myself and rock up to New York City with two suitcases and take a role as a director of coaching for the very first time and learn something new. Not that I wouldn't have learned anything new doing it the other way, but this was much more appealing to me. And I came into a club that was in need of a little bit of development and guidance, but it didn't need my guidance. It needed collectively everybody to buy into a culture. And collectively, we started to build that culture by just setting a few professional habits on a daily basis to start with and building from there. But the biggest thing for me was come in and listen. This is not an environment I know. Given the different layers of leagues and whether it's travel soccer, townships, ECNL, MPL,
it's very complicated
EDP,
over here.
It's complex, and there's no way to figure that all out on your own, I don't think, and really understand it. You need the experience of the people that have been here longer than I had. And pay attention and listen to them whilst trying to build curriculums and build coach education programs and get to know the players and the families that want the best possible experience for their kids. And we did okay. We grew arguably too quick from 17 teams to 75 nationwide, whilst diluting a bit of that quality that you're looking for when you want to develop a club. But nonetheless, it was 3 very valuable years in my learning curve, and got a lot of growth and development out of it.
Brilliant. And then now you're obviously with Beyond Pulse. You're one of the owners. Could you explain a bit about that?
So, yeah, the opportunity arose when my two other co-founders, Marc-Andre Maillé and Michael Supp, who were both born out of the Ohio Master's degree program in sports pedagogy, they they decided to take a road trip to come and talk to me about an idea. So they drove from Ohio, and we kind of locked ourselves in my New York City apartment, which was all of 450 square feet, as you know, Kev.
Welcome to New York City.
And we locked ourselves away for a weekend, and the first thing I heard was, you know, we want to put heart rate monitors on every player in the country. And I was like, I'm not sure about that. Why? And the minute I heard from a coach education perspective, come out of Marc-Andre and kind of Michael's thoughts and what they said next, I was one, intrigued, and two, interested. And the more we talked about how can we build a product that can service the industry to help coaches self-reflect, self-regulate, and create the best possible environment for their players to develop in.
So the basis of it is it's a heart rate monitor, but it's the app then that obviously it gathers all the information and correlates it and spits it back out.
Yep, in a very simple way. We wanted to stay away from the complexity of 25 different metrics and hiring sports scientists to make sense of wearable technology. We wanted to simplify the process so every coach who has a phone can stop and start to connect to the belts en masse. We collect the data. You immediately get an email report on only four metrics. And the one key one we love is active participation. So how active are players within a low, moderate and vigorous zone in your practice? That's one of the key ones we ask coaches to look at first. You get an email report, or you can go into the DOC or technical director dashboard, where you can see every team that's wearing this product in your club, their AP rates, their heart rate zones, distance and speed. However you want to make that relevant, and we are only a guide on that. Every environment is unique. We wanted to simplify the whole process so anybody from a volunteer to an A-licensed coach can look at a metric or two and tweak their practice and their delivery, which in turn will help their players think differently about their own development and performance.
So it's player development, coach development, injury prevention,
the whole
all
thing.
Of the above.
We had an interesting case last year, and from a health and well-being perspective, we had a player at a club here in New Jersey who gave away a penalty 14 minutes before half time, and his heart rate spiked to 100% of its max and stayed there for the next 13 minutes all the way through half time. And you could see where half time regulated, the team average line regulated, and then carried on in 11 minutes into the second half when his team equalized and it dropped back down to the team average. So something had made his heart spike, giving away a penalty. And for nearly 25, 30 minutes, his heart rate stayed there. And we're not a medical device. There's no liability. But we were then able to open dialogue with this player who was screaming inside, but externally looking okay. Yeah. And the dialogue, meaningful dialogue, allowed us to open up this you know, element of him where he was, even in social anxiety like SATs, exams, he was feeling this tension inside that would probably make his heart rate spike. So we were able to help the parents seek advice and help, and for me that is one of the most valuable things coming out of that.
Absolutely, you're opening up conversations about all these different things. It's really, really interesting. And then in terms of how it can help the coaches, the active participation is a big one on that, correct?
It is, yeah. So basically we look at how active your players are on mass with the initial metric you look at. So it'll give you it in a percentage form. And based on some research from the Aspen Institute of Sport, I think released 3 or 4 years ago, 50% of players in the US are receiving less than 50% of a 90-minute practice in terms of being active, which is alarming. So for 45 minutes or more, they're stood around or inactive.
The coach could be coaching too much or too many lines.
So from AP, we're able to give you a guide of your overall group participation within the activities you've developed for them. You can then go in individually and look in three zones, low, moderate and vigorous. So let's say you've got a player in double digits in a vigorous zone for a high tempo Tuesday, and you've got a player in a single digit vigorous zone. Then you might want to have some meaningful dialogue with that player and just say, everything okay? How's everything at home? Tough day at school? What did you eat or drink before you came here? And then players will start to open up. They feel like you care, you're building a bond with them. Now, from a coach perspective, our heart rate graph, we timestamp it. So every time there's a spike in heart rate, it's activity. Every time there's a drop in heart rate, it's inactivity. So you can now measure how often you step in as a coach, how long you speak for. Practice design. Do I have 5-minute water breaks and take 5 minutes to walk from one activity to the next before we get going? All the while creating a value for your stakeholders and parents who just want their kid to have a good experience. Now, if you're a coach taking that level of responsibility for hitting a stop-start button on our app and taking 5 minutes to look at one or two metrics after your practice, I'm pretty sure that as a club, holistically, that's going to create a buy-in from your stakeholders, from your players and parents, and build a nice layer of objective coach education data.
And then in terms of, I know it helps on the kind of college-bound players, players that want to go to college and try and get recruited. Surely that data is great to give to a college coach.
Yeah, we had a case of that where one of our pilot partners here in New Jersey and a DOC for that club had a college coach approach him in a game and say, I love your number 8, but he's a big lad. Can he get around consistently? And you know, Tom Shields at STA was like, well, give me a minute, pulled up his profile in the coach platform. And he was able to show him he was covering 7,500 to 8,000 meters for the past 10, 12 games. And the college coach was like, wow, that's fantastic. Can I get access to that for all the players? And so all of a sudden it adds another layer of value to coach recruitment. One of the additions that we're adding for the college game is that players can now have their own app from April 1st onwards. So that college coaches and even club coaches can track what their players are doing away from your environment.
Yeah.
So off-season programs, and they can share that level of data with you.
And surely the longer you use it, for the amount of years, you build up more information, you can read more into that?
You're building a player footprint, a soccer footprint of every player within your club environment. So you're also building a history of data from your practices, from your output. You can benchmark between age groups and ability levels. You're building a history of your club in one place. So you're not always pulling from your subjective thoughts and how did we perform in this particular tournament? Hey, let's go back and look at the data. And you can attach a lesson plan or video to every single session or game. So you're building a curriculum in the background as well.
And then obviously the coach can look at the data, the technical director can look, and then you as a company, Beyond Pulse, help as a support system?
We do. We're very much a service-based company. So we do check in with our clubs on a regular basis, give them usage reports, what teams are using the product, what type of data they're receiving. We partner with the coaching manual for lesson planning stuff so we can merge kind of quantitative and qualitative data very simply on a lesson plan. So you can now have a target to hit in terms of active participation, heart rate zone, and it's already ready made for you in there. And we're partners with US Club Soccer. We're now a Players First member. So we are a service-based company that won't just give you a product and disappear and say, go hire a 40 grand a year sports scientist to figure out 20 different complex metrics.
Because all the top clubs around the world are using similar stuff, obviously at a, you know, a different level.
Yep.
And there's a massive cost to that. This is kind of simplifying it and making it cost effective.
Absolutely. I mean, those systems at the top end and elite end of the game are phenomenal. Tony Strudwick and Johnny Wilson, who work in the professional environment, and Tony was part of Manchester United's sports science team, well, leading the way. He said he basically condenses that volume of metrics into 3 or 4 anyway. So we were guided, one, by surveying 90 DOCs to see what they wanted before we build the product, and two, to have Tony and Johnny's
like
guidance.
Tony, he's one of the best in the world.
Yep, absolutely. So we were guided by that. We went back to heart rate technology because a lot of clubs in the US go indoors for the winter as well. The GPS is difficult to use indoors. And when you're talking about accuracy, and we have product testing all the time on multiple units, there's not a great deal. We're all slightly inaccurate because technology is only by 3 or 4%, sometimes 7 or 8%. It depends, but it's relative when you get consistent data. Yeah. But we're just a very, very simplified version of those complex products where you can use this yourself as a coach.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And just lastly, it's a big question, but what advice would you give to a young aspiring soccer player? It's a broad question.
It's a broad one. I think for today's modern soccer player and you know, the fight against, or not fight against, social media element, how you perceive yourself, who you really are in real life and who you want to be on social media, all of these things play into that person's character, how they feel about themselves, who they are. For me, ask the people around you who you trust for advice on what you need to work on. If there's a coach you trust, a DOC you trust, mom and dad, friends that are genuinely understanding of who you are as a person, not going and looking at the next highlight reel from Messi and Ronaldo, because as engaging as that can be, you're only seeing an end product of two of the best players in the world, or any elite player. You're seeing the end product. You don't realize the daily habits, just from a characteristic perspective, you have to have and adhere to if you're going to aspire to be a professional in this game at any level. Really pay attention to the advice that people who you trust, that you value, are giving to you, and then go and work at it. Have a desire to work away from your club environment. Have a desire to get a ball out.
It's not every enough opportunity. Just to train two or three times with your club.
It's nowhere near enough. Yeah. And whenever you get an opportunity to go out onto a field with a ball, make it worthwhile. Don't go through the motions when you think nobody's looking. Because they're the moments where, and this is a layer of imagination that I think might be missing a little, because we're getting very familiar with technology and almost overuse of it. And that's coming from somebody who's building a technology product. You know, be creative. Create scenarios in your head. If you're taking free kicks, don't just take free kicks. I'm Manchester United in the last 5 minutes of a Champions League game, and we've got to score this to go through to the next round. Create that internal pressure and imagine it around you. And whenever I work with teams and players, I like to create scenarios where they can be imaginative with it. And it's an important part of development. Because I used to watch a lot of games, I was able to recreate scenarios that happened in games I saw.
It's like that mental visualization. And
yeah, absolutely. Bring it to a reality in your own head, so that it is you stood over a ball in a Man City, a Man United, a Barcelona jersey. You're imagining a goalkeeper in there, even if it's between two trees.
Yeah.
Imagine the goals there. And, you know, celebrate when you score. Who cares if somebody's looking? Repetition, do it again. Do it time and time again. And you don't need the perfect setup or the perfect scenario to develop your skill set, to develop your mindset. You just need a field, a ball, and something to bounce it off every now and again.
Yeah, brilliant. Mark, thanks for coming today. I really appreciate it. You have an amazing story, and your product is absolutely brilliant, and you obviously have massive success already with it.
No, thanks for having me on, Kevin. Good to trade a few stories there, mate.
Brilliant, thanks.